Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Riley Kandel. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we spoke with Nicholas Short. Dr. Short is an associate professor in the Department of Leukemia of the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Short discussed evolving factors at play in the Philadelphia chromosome-positive acute lymphoblastic leukemia space, the use of TKIs like ponatinib, and how the treatment stacks up against others in the space, in addition to evolving approaches that incorporate treatments like blinatumomab, were all covered in our discussion with Dr. Short.
Just in general, for patients with pH-positive ALL, you know, what are some of the factors that ultimately drive TKI selection for an individual patient?
Yeah, so, you know, for a long time, we didn't have any randomized data to support one TKI or another. So really, in the past, we've used both, you know, toxicity profile, and then we were just comparing across single-arm studies, right? So, you know, from a toxicity profile perspective, you know, we have to think, you know, we have a lot of data, for example, in CML with these same TKIs, and of course, data for pH-positive ALL. So, you know, you want to make sure that you're not giving a patient a TKI that obviously is contraindicated for them. So, for example, sure, you know, we'll talk about ponatinib. You know, ponatinib is a very potent TKI, but it has with it, you know, certain risk of cardiovascular toxicity. So you have to be careful about, you know, using that in a particular patient. Dasatinib is an association with pulmonary hypertension. So you want to avoid that for certain patients. So, you know, that's certainly a factor. And then, you know, for a long time, we had various single arm studies that generally suggested that as we went from, you know, imatinib first generation to the second generation and then to third generation ponatinib, that we saw deeper responses and what looked like better survival. But it's, of course, it's always hard to compare across single arm studies. I think now we have data from the Falcon study. This was a randomized study of patients who with newly diagnosed pH positive ALL who had low dose chemotherapy with imatinib or low dose chemotherapy with ponatinib. And, you know, the data look better with ponatinib. We're still waiting for, you know, mature data for survival, for example, but we see it met its primary endpoint, higher rates of MRD negative remissions, what looks like better event-free survival so far. Again, overall survival will need to mature. So I think if someone were trying to decide between imatinib and ponatinib and there was no contraindication, then ponatinib would be the obvious answer based on those data. Now, the question is ponatinib better than second generation TKIs? We don't have randomized data to support that. However, I think if you look across single arm studies, ponatinib certainly looks to lead to deeper responses, better long-term survival. And we know ponatinib is active against these T315I mutations, which can occur over the course of therapy and lead to resistance with the first or second generation inhibitors. So there's theoretical advantages to ponatinib. I think a lot of the data look like ponatinib is better than second generation TKIs, but the only real good randomized data we have right now is imatinib versus ponatinib.
Since we're on the topic of ponatinib, you know, again, as you know, we're still waiting on some updated data from the Falcon data. So again, as you said, they mature. But, you know, with this agent specifically, you know, where in clinical practice are you looking to utilize it right now? And are there particular patients that you're saying, hey, I'd prefer ponatinib here over a potential other option?
So my current approach, and it has been actually for years, you know, even prior to the Falcon data, because we ran a lot of the studies with ponatinib here at MD Anderson, but is that unless a patient has a contraindication to ponatinib, that has been our go-to frontline TKI. And that's just because, you know, there was already data that had that we had generated and others as well with like chemotherapy plus ponatinib, where the, you know, depth of response was very high. We're talking about deep molecular response, 70-80+%, long-term survival rates over 70%, you know, better than what we had seen historically with other TKIs. And so really our default is ponatinib. Of course, again, the question would be if a patient has a severe cardiovascular comorbidities or history of pancreatitis, certain of these toxicities that we know can come up with ponatinib, then we would consider other TKIs. But really the default would be ponatinib frontline unless there's a specific reason not to give it for a particular patient.
You mentioned the T315I mutations before, and certainly that's a very relevant mutation within this patient population. So what is the importance of, you know, A, checking that status and then using it to inform treatment decisions via when you have a patient in front of you?
For patients with newly diagnosed PH-positive ALL, the data are a bit mixed in terms of whether or not these ABL1 kinase domain mutations, these TKI resistance mutations, are present at diagnosis at a very low level and then expand over the course of therapy or whether they emerge later. Some studies have suggested that if you actually look, you can find these small T315I subclones present, and others have suggested that they're not there at any appreciable level at diagnosis. So that's still potentially, I would say, unresolved. That said, it's very clear that those mutations emerge or expand, whatever it is, over the course of therapy for patients with first who receive first or second generation TKIs. So imatinib, dasatinib, nilotinib, et cetera. And so these T315I mutations account for up to 75% of the relapse. So it's really the dominant mechanism of relapse for patients who receive your first or second generation TKI. That's the rationale for using ponatinib in the frontline setting. We don't use this testing at baseline to make a decision because, again, with any standard methodology, patients don't have these mutations. So you wouldn't be using this to select the therapy. Now, they can emerge over the course of therapy. So when we test the kinase domain mutations at the time of relapse, and that's where if a patient were on a first or second generation inhibitor, it's very likely that that would be driven by the T315I. For patients on ponatinib, we can still see relapses, but there are other rare ABL1 kinase mutations that can occur for those patients. And sometimes there's no mutation identified, and it's probably some BCR-ABLE independent mechanism that's leading to relapse.
Certainly some, you know, good nuances there to highlight. But, you know, just again, with the importance of you know, having these mutations, statuses, especially, you know, at relapse and selecting those later line therapies, you know, what is just that importance of testing and how do you underscore that to community docs and people, you know, around the world that, you know, may not be doing this on a consistent basis?
It's extremely important if you are deciding on your TKI at relapse. In another way, I could make an argument that it's actually not incredibly important depending on the scenario. So for example, if a patient received imatinib combination frontline or dasatinib and they relapse, it's as I said, 75% of them will have a T315I. So you can pretty much assume that. But really the question is that information going to change the TKI I use? Well, if a patient didn't receive ponatinib in the frontline setting, I would give it to them at relapse regardless of whether or not that is present. So it's always good to have more data. You might potentially use a higher dose of ponatinib for those patients. I mean, I think there's data in CML that patients who have a T315I mutation, that higher doses of ponatinib may be effective. But the truth is, even if a patient, you know, relapses on imatinib or dasatinib, and you test the ABL1 kinase domain mutation and it's negative, that doesn't mean that you can select another second generation inhibitor. I mean, once a patient relapses, you really need to be very aggressive with your therapy. So I would, you know, I would always be using ponatinib in that patient. Or we have clinical trials with asciminib or olverembatinib, which is kind of a new TKI that's in a lot of trials. But essentially, like, it is always good to document that and to be aware of these mutations. I would say, though, it's more of a rationale for using the ponatinib early on and less so something that you use to guide your therapy later. Because unlike CML, if a patient has, you know, they are on imatinib and then they develop a mutation to imatinib, but it's sensitive to dasatinib, it's very reasonable to move them to a second generation inhibitor. But for these acute leukemia like pH-positive ALL, if they relapse, it's very aggressive disease, you want to give them the most potent TKI available. And as of right now, that is ponatinib, regardless of what the kinase domain mutation profile is.
Thank you for expanding on that as well. Obviously, you know, this has been a TKI-driven conversation here because they're such a staple of the ALL treatment paradigm in the pH-positive patient population. But, you know, obviously, given all that, you know, what other agents, what other, you know, strategies are you potentially looking at in the future as, you know, something to build on these TKIs and what we've seen here? And are there any ongoing investigations you're watching or participating in right now?
So when we talked about the TKI selection, which I think is very important, but the question is, what backbone regimen do we give with that? Because we don't treat patients with newly diagnosed or really even relapsed refractory pH-positive ALL with a TKI ALL. So it's always the combination of something. So I think for a long time, the standard was some sort of intensive chemotherapy backbone, hyper-CVAD or something similar in combination with a TKI. And with, for example, hyper-CVAD plus ponatinib, we saw excellent results by your survival rate, 75% or so. Now, really, the paradigm has shifted to use very commonly chemotherapy-free regimens with blinatumomab. So blinatumomab plus TKI, we're usually giving blinatumomab and ponatinib. And so we can now treat these patients with chemotherapy-free regimens, avoid chemotherapy for patients, which they certainly appreciate. And the data so far look like the outcomes are at least as good as intensive chemotherapy. And it does look like are probably better, although we'll need longer follow-up, larger studies to really get a better idea of that. But so these are very effective regimens, and so that's usually our backbone of choice. Now, it varies depending on where people are practicing. Some experts will still use chemotherapy-based backbones, and certainly outside the U.S., that's commonly used. But I would say more and more centers inside the U.S. now are using chemotherapy-free regimens, blinatumomab plus TKI. Some are using dasatinib, some ponatinib. My preference is to use, as I mentioned, ponatinib whenever possible. So right now, the outcomes are very good with blinatumomab plus TKI. Now, at relapse, I think I think it's less clear what should be done. I do think a very potent TKI should be used. So ponatinib, you can consider clinical trials with hadavacimab or olverembatinib, for example. But I wouldn't use the TKI alone. So then what do you combine it with? You can combine it with blinatumomab. You can combine it. I think there's some data about inotuzumab, which is also approved for Philadelphia chromosome negative ALL. So you could use that in combination with a TKI. And of course, CAR T cells would still have a role for these patients as well. We usually try to get them into remission, though, with blina, ponatinib, or whatever else it is, give them CAR T cell therapy, and then usually after that, maintain the response with a TKI for some amount of time. Some patients will go to stem cell transplant, but I think it's still an open question, even in relapse for pH-positive ALL with the better therapies we have now. Do we need to send these patients for transplant at first relapse? Not entirely clear. In my practice, I often will do CAR T cells as a more definitive therapy and avoid transplant, even for relapsed patients.
So I guess a final question for me, again, kind of tying together everything we've kind of talked about here with the evolving use of TKIs in pH-positive ALL, what would be your kind of main message for colleagues, just who are navigating these treatment selections and just the most important things to keep in mind, when treating patients with pH-positive ALL?
First of all, pH-positive ALL is a rare disease. I think it is always best, if possible, for these patients to be treated at a large volume center that is very experienced with the nuances of these approaches. That said, I would argue that the data fraught with blinatumomab plus a TKI, particularly blinatumomab plus ponatinib, look excellent. And so that would be our standard of care at MD Anderson. And I know many are currently using this approach. But there, if you're using a chemotherapy-free regimen, it is in some ways simpler than standard chemotherapy and less toxic. But there are certain factors to keep in mind, such as intrathecal prophylaxis, which we see higher rates of central nervous system relapses in patients treated with these chemotherapy-free regimens. So we've increased the number of doses of intrathecal chemotherapy. Monitoring of MRD is very important. So using these next-generation sequencing-based MRD assays and PCR, and how do you interpret the data? How do you adjust the dose of ponatinib over time? So we start usually at, for example, 30 milligrams, and then we reduce it to 15 when patients have a good MRD response. So even though it's in some ways simpler than the chemotherapy approaches, there still are several nuances to this. There are patients who have a higher risk of CNS relapses. Those patients, for example, with a very high white count at presentation, we consider those patients for CAR T cell therapy. I think that not all patients can travel to tertiary care centers. I think it is ideal if these patients can be treated at large volume centers, or at the very least with some communication with experts, because these are rare diseases. So most community oncologist, even if they have some specialty interest in leukemia, will not see that many of these patients. So I think with how fast the field is moving, I think it's very important to be in contact with some of the disease experts, again, for some of these more nuanced treatment decisions.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at @OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many other of your favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.